Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Playing games might be a year-round hobby for some of us, but buying games is more generally a holiday season pastime. Since 2010, writer, editor, and games expert James Lauder has joined us during the holiday season to share something we call his Games to Gift list.
This year, we talk about some of the trends in the game world, along with his suggestions in role-playing, hobby, family, and other game categories. Jim Lauder, welcome back to the show.
Great to see you, too.
So we always start this conversation with a bit of a conversation about trends in the game industry. And I guess I'm interested to have you talk a little bit about how things have evolved in the 12 months since you were last in the studio.
Well, the thing that's kind of amazing this year is the continuing ascent of role-playing games, which is a definitely kind of a niche type of games. But Dungeons & Dragons is getting ever more popular, moving into the public imagination the way that superheroes did just a few years ago.
Well, let me ask a question about that, because I remember playing Dungeons & Dragons when, you know, I was 8, 9, 10 years old, and it was back in the 1980s. Is this a generational thing? Is it the offspring of the D&D players from 25, 30 years ago who are getting into it now?
It is. That's partly what's going on. It's partly a generation who grew up playing role-playing games on video games, such as Final Fantasy and things like that, and want to know what the live in-person experience, what's this like playing with actual people at an actual table? And that's actually one of the things that is amazing about how this is growing. It's the growth of the actual play videos and the internet as a gateway for people into the hobby. So there are shows like Critical Role on Geek & Sundry where you watch people play Dungeons & Dragons.
Well, what do you get out of watching other people play Dungeons & Dragons?
Maybe
that's a dumb question. I don't know.
No, it's not really, because for people, the older generation who played, you learned by someone at the table teaching you how to play. What people now get out of it is an experience that they can share with their friends and say, see, we can do this. They get to see what a game looks like, and it removes all of the threat and all of the mystery about what a role-playing game is.
Is there an effective difference in the, I don't know, social experience of sitting down and playing a role-playing game versus sitting down with your friends and playing any other kind of game? Is it a different experience you have around the table?
Well, role-playing games by design are supposed to be group storytelling. So you are creating something that is unique, and it's unique that you replace one of the people at the table and the story goes in a different direction. Their character is different and they take the narrative in a different direction. So it's a unique experience. The interesting part about that, as far as trends go too, though, is other types of games like board games moving narrative into their structure.
All right. So with that in mind, let's get straight to the list and with some role-playing games. And one at the top of your list is something called Kids on Bikes, which to me kind of looked like a cross between Dungeons and Dragons and the Hardy Boys.
Yes. And if you're familiar with Stranger Things or the older show Erie, Indiana, you have an idea of what this game is trying to replicate, that idea of pre-internet age kids discovering mysteries in their town and banding together to solve them, keep people safe. And the great thing about the game is it's rules light. It's focused on storytelling and narrative. It's a clever mechanic where you build the town that you'll be playing in at the same time you design your characters. So it's focused on inclusivity, which is also another great thing for a role-playing game to do, make sure everybody's feeling comfortable at the table. And it's a clever little starter.
And I was in your brief write-up about it, I'm intrigued by the concept that there is a soft cover version and a hard cover version. What does that mean when it comes to games?
It means that it's really just a format difference, and it depends on how what you think of your books as. Even just on production values, the second role-playing game I mentioned this year is the Prince Valiant storytelling game, which was originally released in the late 80s as a black and white soft cover. But this is a game built around Hal Foster's classic comic strip, and they're gorgeous and they should be seen in color. And this new edition is a hardcover with color, full color art, and it's a lovely book as a book. And the game itself is marvelous. It's the design of Greg Stafford, the Grand Shaman of Gaming. and published by Stuart Wick. And for sentimental reasons, this is one of my picks for the year because both Greg and Stuart passed away in the last couple of years, and both were dear friends. The game itself can be boiled down to one page of rules. It's expanded on in the game book, but the conflict mechanic in this is a coin toss. You can learn this game incredibly quickly. It's a wonderful gateway into role-playing. So if you're curious about what role-playing is, Prince Valiant's the game for you.
Great. Let's talk about hobby games now. And first of all, what do you mean when you say hobby games?
A hobby game is one that demands more than casual attention. There's a strategy involved that you can pick up playing multiple times. It's one that you'll go back to time and again. People spend a lot of energy into figuring out the best way to play and the best strategies involved.
A friend and I in high school, there was a game called Status Pro Baseball that we would play entire seasons. So 162 games against each other, one after another, and that would take months. This is kind of what you're talking about.
Oh, right. Yes. And this is the classic role-playing game campaign. That's a hobby game. Chess can be a hobby game, things like that. Roto baseball, roto football, things like that, where you're spending all your time looking at the stats and all of that. Those are hobbies. That's a game that's asking for more of your time.
And first on the list is from a game company that I remember from my childhood, Avalon Hill. This is a game called Betrayal Legacy.
And Betrayal Legacy is one of those great examples of a board game using narrative as well. The legacy-style games are ones where you change the board, you change the cards as you play. So everybody's experience with the game, depending on what group you're playing with, is different. You end up with a different playing experience. Betrayal is based on Betrayal at the House on the Hill, an older game, which was a explore the haunted house, figure out who's the traitor among you. It's a very well-designed game, and it's a lot of fun. What they did with this is backed it up, and over a prologue and 13 episodes, you determine how the house got haunted. So you and your group and the players that you have around your table determine the story for the house, and things that you do from game session to game session will continue. So items that were connected to one particular family will stay connected to that one family over the course of it. And the thing that's very clever about this design is many other legacy games, you finish playing the series of games and you are done. You finish the board game and you're finished. When you're done playing Betrayal Legacy, you have a playable version of the game that you can continue playing with that backstory that you've created attached.
All right. So that was Betrayal Legacy. What about Keyforge Call of the Archons?
Archons, yes. This is the latest card game designed by Richard Garfield, the man who designed Magic the Gathering, which you may be familiar with.
Vaguely popular
game. The thing that's interesting about this is it's not a collectible game like Magic the Gathering, so you can improve your card deck through booster packs, and it's not a deck draw game where you have a larger number of cards, fixed cards, and you draw your different deck that you use each time. Each deck is unique, and every time you play, you will have that unique deck that is only your deck. And Richard is a combinatorial mathematics guy, so I trust him when he says there are quadrillions of different versions of this deck out there.
There's a reason this is for ages 14 and up.
Exactly, yes. And there's a deeper strategy to it. And the thing that's great about this as a card game is a lot of the other card games like Magic, it's about what cards you can acquire. And that becomes expensive and it's very time consuming and you spend your time chasing cards. Here, what you're being invited to do is figure out the best way to play the unique deck you have. So each deck will have strengths and weaknesses, but you'll only discover those as you play them, and it's inviting you to kind of play the hand you're dealt, which is a clever way to do it.
Great. Let's talk family games now, starting with Magic Maze.
Magic Maze is a cooperative game, and those are very popular right now. There's a great Matt Leacock game, Forbidden Sky, which is the latest entry in Forbidden Island, Forbidden Desert, both of which have been mentioned in the show before. But Magic Maze does something clever with the design, too. There is no talking at the table. which
it's a slightly different social experience.
It is. And one of the weaknesses of co-op games is that you can get sort of a domineering player at the table who designs what everybody needs to do on their turn to make the game work and to reach the solution. And this eliminates that possibility by, for much of the game, players cannot talk. They can stare at each other if they need the other player to do something. There is a do something token, which you can pick up and move and put in front of the other player to get them to do something. But each of the players at the table has a limited number of things they can do. They can make one action, like one player will be able to move tokens north, and that's all they can do. And so you need to cooperate and have each player use their strengths to get the fantasy heroes to the locations in the mall. They're looting a mall. They've been dropped off in a mall, and they need to loot the mall to get their equipment and escape before security gets them. And so you're working together to get everyone their equipment and then get out before the mall security gets you.
I have a 10-year-old and a 14-year-old at home, and imagining them attempting to play this without talking is a tall order.
Yes, and this is it's all done on an egg timer as well, so there's a level of frantic that is added to this. Not necessarily the game for every family, but it's a very clever twist on the usual co-op game.
Okay, if that is not for every family, there is one game on this list that appears to have been expressly designed for my family, and that is Flamme Rouge. The question is it appealing to a wider cross-section of people than just fans of the Tour de France?
It is. It's a bike racing game, and as a race game, it's very easy to access because you can see what you're trying to do when you play. It's a modular board. You get to set up different stages, and each one has different difficulties. When you get to the mountains, it's going to change the rules a little bit. But you have your two riders, and you are trying to be the first person across the finish line for that stage. You use energy cards for movement. You move too fast and get out ahead. You get hit with exhaustion cards. There are things like slipstreaming. So if you end a turn in a specific space, you move up on the board. So there are some really clever mechanics to it, but it is not overly complicated. It's very fast to play and quite a lot of fun.
Did I see, are there expansion packs for this as well?
There are, yes.
All right, so let's switch to a slightly younger demographic. Games especially for kids or somewhat younger kids than what we were talking about before, starting with a game called Camel Up.
Camel Up is another race game. In this one, you're betting on different colored camels as they race around a pyramid. It's got a little more wacky to it. It's a little less strategy-based than something like Flamme Rouge. It's a remake of a game from just a couple of years ago where they upped the quality of the components, and they also added some rules like rogue camels that run backwards on the course. So that's what makes this one a little better for younger kids than just a pure strategy game like Cryptid. It's quite a lot of fun, and the new edition is actually quite a nice improvement over the one from just a few years ago.
Outstanding. What does Fireball Island: The Curse of Vulkar bring to the table?
It's another redo. It's been a weaker year for games for younger kids, but these two are sort of standouts, but they're also redos. But Fireball Island started as a gigantic Kickstarter. It's a redo of a 1986 Milton Bradley game, which is kind of a classic American game as toy. It's an island where there's an angry volcano that's spitting marbles, fireball marbles at you as your explorers run around the island trying to collect treasure. Fireball Island, the new version, makes the island a little bigger and adds some other great strategy mechanics to it. So that at its base, it's a great kids game. It's the kind of game you remember as a kid where it's like Mousetrap, or for the older folks, Voice of the Mummy and things like that.
Operation
where it's right. There's a dexterity mechanic involved here too when you push the marbles down the mountains and possibly try to knock your rivals off of the paths and things like that. But if you get the expansions for it, there are other things that this adds, like player powers and secret agendas and things like that, which scale Fireball Island up from it's a fun kids and family game to up to the hobby game territory. There's a lot of strategy involved depending on the expansions you pick up.
All right, moving on now to a category called party games and a game called Unrivaled. What does that bring to us?
One of the weaknesses of party games is that if you don't like trivia, you're going to be handed a game where the entire game is based around something you feel is a weakness or something that doesn't interest you. And Unrivaled answers that by making the challenges all kinds of different things. So there's physical challenges, there are trivia challenges, there are solo challenges, there are group challenges. It's all of them mixed together. And they do a lot of really clever different kinds of things. For example, the teams working together have 2 minutes to write a love song about a pet and then perform it. And part of the goal there is to have good lyrics and also a decent performance, and that gets voted on.
I'm having nightmares about that that challenge already.
Exactly. Yes. And but the advantage of Unrivaled is if that isn't your cup of tea, the next challenge could be a trivia challenge.
Excellent. So, Unrivaled. And in the category of stocking stuffers, this is a great time of year to find some catchy games that are somewhat more economically priced and maybe a little more portable.
Yes, and I mean the board games now the advantage prices have sort of settled down. The average games for these sorts of projects are $40 to $50 is average. Fireball Island and Betrayal Legacy are more expensive, but you're also getting a lot more stuff with those. Stocking stuff, but you can still find really great games at a reasonable price. And Trash Pandas is a great example of that. It's a game where you're playing raccoons trying to find food and shiny things in the local trash cans. But the mechanics have you rolling a dice to gather tokens to be able to do things with your cards, either draw more cards or steal cards or stash cards away for victory points at the end of the game. And there's a push your luck mechanic attached to it where if you can keep rolling, but if you keep rolling and you repeat a dice roll, then you've lost all your progress for that round. So for a little game that costs about $12, it's got a lot of replayability to it, and it's a lot of fun.
All right. We've been teasing everyone for the last 15 or 20 minutes or so leading up to your top pick for 2018. And having seen this list ahead of time, I went and looked it up, and it looks like an amazing game. What is at the top of the list?
The top of the list this year is Azul, and it is a game where you are artisans who have been called by the King of Portugal to lay tile and make his palace beautiful. And it's a very well-designed game where you are drawing tiles and lining them up on your wall board and then eventually trying to complete a horizontal row of tile on the wall. And when you complete the first player completes a horizontal row, the game ends. It's a fast-playing game, half an hour or so, but a lot of strategy because you draw tiles based not only on what you need but based on trying to make the other players draw tiles next that they can't use because tiles that are wasted count against you at the end of the game.
It's almost a little card playing here.
It is, and the pieces are really nice. They're nice little resin squares, so there's a great tactile facet to the game. It was also reimagined as a stained glass building window, also out now. Both versions of the game are out, and that's lovely too. It has little translucent glass tile pieces. They're marvelous games.
There's a game my kids love called Labyrinth that
yes.
this sounds a little reminiscent of as well.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, because there's a strategy to how you place the tiles on the wall depends on what order you draw them in and how you place them on your wall board as you're building the design.
How many games would you say that you play over the course of a year?
Not enough.
That's
really the answer. The thing that's interesting is I've been playing a lot more role-playing games in the last couple of years, especially at conventions. I've been running more The horror role-playing game Call of Cthulhu is a favorite, and I've been running more scenarios for that, which is a ball. I hadn't done it in a couple of decades, and I'd forgotten how much fun it was.
Well, Jim Lauder, thank you as always. It's great to talk to you, and let's talk again soon.
Absolutely.
James Lauder is a writer and the editor of the award-winning anthologies Hobby Games, the 100 Best, and Family Games, the 100 Best. He joins us every year with our annual Games to Gift list. There were a handful of games that we ran out of time for our on-air segment, but you can find the complete list at wuwm.com.